in the United States, calling him the rightful heir to Thomas Edison. And Preble's broadcasting included Ray as one of 16 revolutionaries who made America, along with other inventors of the past two centuries. As one of the leading inventors of our time, Ray was the principal developer of the first CCD flatbed scanner, the first Omnifont optical character recognition, the first print-to-speech reading machine for the blind, the first text-to-speech synthesizer, the first music synthesizer capable of recreating the grand piano and other orchestral instruments, and the first commercially marketed large vocabulary speech recognition. Ray's website, KurzweilAI.net, has over 1 million readers. Among Ray's many honors, he is the recipient of the $500,000 MIT Lemelson Prize, the world's largest for innovation. In 1999, he received the National Medal of Technology from President Clinton in a White House ceremony. And in 2002, he was inducted into the National Inventors Hall of Fame. Ray has written 5 books, 4 of which have been national bestsellers. The Age of Spiritual Machines has been translated into 9 languages and was the number one best-selling book on Amazon in science. Ray's latest book, The Singularity Is Near, was a New York Times bestseller and has been the number one book on Amazon in both science and philosophy. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Ray Kurzweil.
Well, thanks. It's great to be with you here on your 20th anniversary. I thought those movies were great. I mean, it was very moving. And a good introduction of what I'll share with you today, and also a good example of one key phenomena. I actually spoke to this group in 1994. How many of you were there in 1994? Well, a few hands, but a lot of newcomers. But back in 1994, you couldn't have done these kinds of movies. This type of technology is very empowering. It's very democratizing of the tools of creation. You know, if you think back to 1994, if you wanted to make a full-length motion picture, you had to be a big Hollywood studio. You had to command a multi-million dollar recording studio if you wanted to create an album. If you wanted to create computer technology, you had to be a big company or a big government agency. That's no longer the case. Kids with their $500 very high quality camera and software, the titles of which you just heard, costing a few hundred dollars each, can create a full-length motion picture. And there have been successful pictures made by people who have just passion and very little financial resources, like March of the Penguins was quite successful. That was done on a very low budget. There's a lot of other examples. Movie albums are made by kids in their dorm rooms that reach commercial success. A couple of kids at Stanford wrote a bit of software on their personal computers that cost $1,000 each. It's now worth $100 billion. You probably use it to search the web. So this is very empowering technology. And the power of this type of technology is accelerating. It's doubling every year. And that's going to be one key message I'd like to share with you. That's very explosive growth. The price performance, the capacity, the bandwidth of information technology doubles every year. That's multiplying by 1,000 in 10 years. 1 billion in 30 years is actually a slow second level of exponential growth. It will be 25 years. We will amplify the power of these technologies 1 billion-fold. And if you look at the power that they have already and add 1 billion-fold increase in their capability, while at the same time we shrink the key features of technology, according to my model, is a factor of 100 per decade, 3D volume, that's 100,000, 25 years, you get some idea of what will be feasible. Now when I spoke to this group back in 94, I made a few predictions, predicted that we would see a succession of electronic books purporting to replace print books. Invariably, when new technology is introduced, they have certain advantages. Electronic book allows you to search the contents. You can, you know, take 10 books with you without having to lug 50 pounds of material. But invariably they're missing some key features, at least in the first generation, and the second and the third. And indeed that's exactly what happened. The first generation electronic books were missing some of the key qualities of paper. They didn't have the resolution, they didn't have the contrast, the viewing angle, they flickered. I felt actually that in about 10 or 12 years that a satisfactory electronic book could be introduced. I think we're seeing that now. If you look at the latest crop of electronic books, like the one from Sony, where it really looks just like paper and has the contrast of viewing angle and other qualities of paper. But it wouldn't immediately eclipse books. I would say that if we come back in 10, 12 years, let alone 20 years, print books will really be an obsolete technology. Obsolete technologies don't go away, they still linger, but it's no longer the cutting edge. I predicted we'd be using computers to do research, and that we'd be rarely going to physical libraries. That seemed pretty absurd back in 94, when there was no online research material. But now think about how you do research very casually. I mean, in a few minutes, you use search engines, you can find what any teacher or professor has said, you can find out anything about anybody. Most research material is now coming online. It's an extremely powerful tool, and it's amplifying our mental capabilities. The first industrial revolution extended our physical reach. We're now extending our mental reach. And both of these industrial revolutions have been eliminating jobs at the bottom of the skill ladder, creating new jobs at the top of the skill ladder. So the skill ladder has moved up, and that puts more emphasis on education. And although we focused in on education in a micro level from year to year as a political issue, if you take a broad view, go back to 1870, you'll see how profound the trends have been in education. We had 50,000 college students in 1870. It's 6 million today. We're actually spending 10 times as much in constant dollars per capita on K through 12. And the effectiveness of that is being amplified by technology, which is working in a collaboration with human intelligence. In fact, if you look at technology in general now, take science, I mean, most science is impossible without computers. Even mathematics, which you think is just a pure mental activity, the latest two major theorems that were solved were done in collaboration between humans and computers, and the mathematicians said it would have been possible if they didn't have these computer tools. And very few professionals, and certainly all of you, you know, would find it very difficult, if not impossible, to do their jobs without our computer technology. And I'd like to take a broad view of this and look at where we've come and where we're going. I began actually studying technology trends about 30 years ago. Because of my interest in being an inventor, I realized that timing was key to success in invention. Most inventions fail, not because the inventor can't get the thing to work, but because the timing is wrong, the market isn't ready, not all the enabling factors are in place when they're needed. And realizing this, I became an ardent student of technology trends. Being an engineer, I collected a lot of data, built mathematical models. I saw, after a few years, that these models were actually quite predictive. And this has kind of taken on a life of its own. I have a group of 10 people now that helps me gather data in many different fields, and we build mathematical models. And they really follow very predictable outcomes. In my first book, which I wrote 20 years ago, in the mid-80s, had hundreds of predictions about the mid-1990s and the early 2000 years, which are tracked very accurately. For example, I saw the ARPANET, which was not on anybody's radar map. It was used by a couple thousand scientists. It was 20,000 nodes going to 40,000, then to 80,000. But doubling every year, as I mentioned, is multiplying by 1,000 in 10 years. So I felt that this would be a worldwide web tying together tens, hundreds of millions of people. It would go from 20 million to 40 million to 80 million to 160 million in the mid-1990s. And would tie together the whole world with a vast information and knowledge network. That seemed absurd in the mid-1980s when it was a very slow, unreliable network tying together a couple thousand scientists. But in fact, it happened quite on time. The first reference to the World Wide Web was 1993 in the New York Times. So in 1994, when I spoke to you last, most people had not yet heard of the World Wide Web. So it's 12 years ago, and the World Wide Web was really not a reality. That sounds like ancient history. And things have continued to accelerate. Think back 5 years. Most people didn't use search engines. I mean, imagine life without search engines. That sounds like ancient history. That was 5 years ago. 3 years ago, people didn't use the word blog, social network, podcast. You heard the students describe how rapidly, just in 3 years, they've gone from fairly crude film tools to digital tools to high definition tools in very short order. You know, 3 years ago people were saying you can't make money in internet advertising. Now you've got, you know, one company I just mentioned, Google, that is worth $100 billion, gets $12 billion in revenue in internet advertising. And the pace of change is continuing to accelerate. In fact, this doubling of information technology capability every year accelerates the basic pace of progress. Now, hundreds of years ago, people didn't realize that there was such a thing as progress. Their grandparents lived the same lives they did. They fully expected their grandchildren to do the same. That began to change with the Industrial Revolution around 1800. And now people will say, yes, change is a constant. But change is not a constant. Change is accelerating. But that's really not intuitively obvious. And it's remarkable to me how many sophisticated scientists fail to grasp this key point. I recently spoke a couple of years ago at Time Magazine's Future of Life conference on the 50th anniversary of the discovery of the structure of DNA, and all of us speakers were asked, okay, what will the next 50 years bring? Every speaker there, except for one other gentleman, Bill Joy, who talks about the downside of these technologies, and myself, used the last 50 years as a model for the next 50 years, and that's just wrong. We're doubling the paradigm shift rate every decade. The next 50 years will be 32 times more change than the last 50 years. So Jim Watson himself, the co-discoverer of DNA, said, oh, in 50 years we'll have drugs that enable you to eat as much as you want and remain slim. And I said, Jim, we've already done that in animals by blocking the fat insulin receptor gene. That gene basically says hold on to every calorie because the next hunting season may not work out so well. These animals ate ravenously and remained slim, and they got and it wasn't a fake slimness, they got the benefits of being slim, they didn't get diabetes and get heart disease, they lived 20% longer, they got the benefits of caloric restriction while doing the opposite. Five pharmaceutical companies have noticed, hey, that'd be a pretty good drug for the human market, and they're rushing fat insulin receptor gene inhibitors to the human market. We have to go through the FDA, but it'll be more like one decade or less, not five decades. All the predictions were very overly conservative, really. Some of them talked about things we'll see in 3 or 4 years, looking at the next generation, and then their imagination failed them. But there's a continual acceleration, and you only have to look back 5 years ago to see how different technology was, certainly in education, to imagine, to grasp this basic acceleration in the rate of progress. Now, you might wonder, you know, how can you really reliably predict the future? The common wisdom is the future is unpredictable. You can't predict the future. And that's true when it comes to specific projects. You know, will one specific program succeed or fail in education or in software? Any one company, any one individual, that's very unpredictable. What will the next wireless standard be? Wi-Fi, CDMA, G3, that's hard to predict. But the overall impact of these technologies is very easy to predict. If you ask me, well, what will the cost of a MIPS with computing be in 2010, or what will the spatial resolution of brain scanning be in 2012, or how much will it cost to sequence a base pair of DNA in 2014, I can give you a figure, and it's likely to be quite accurate. And I say this now not just backfitting to past data, I've been making these forward-looking predictions for a long time. In fact, another prediction I made in the mid-80s is that computer would take the World Chess Championship in 1998, because I saw the chess supercomputers doubling in power every year. The chess score is a log scale, so that basically resulted in adding 40 points to the chess score every year. That put the crossover at 98. That seemed absurd when most individuals who were casual chess players could defeat chess machines in the mid-80s. Kasparov, the world champion, was asked about this prediction in 93, and he said, that's ridiculous. I've played the best chess machines in the world, and they're pathetic, they're predictable, they're very brittle. And that was true in 93, but they saw it past him in 97. Exponential growth is very seductive, it's very unpredictable. It's very hard to predict if you don't really look at these exponential trends, because it becomes explosive when you start doubling significant numbers. But you might wonder, how could this be? How can we make reliable predictions about these future trends when each individual project is unreliable and unpredictable? Well, we see other examples in science of the same phenomenon. In fact, the classic example comes from the 19th century, thermodynamics. The path of each particle in a gas is completely unpredictable. In fact, it's modeled with a random walk. So you can't tell where that molecule will be 10 seconds from now. Yet the overall properties of the gas are very predictable to a very high degree of precision, according to the laws of thermodynamics. If you have a large dynamic system where each element is random and chaotic, the overall performance of that system has certain features that are quite predictable. And technology evolution is just such a dynamic, chaotic, random system. Each project individual is unpredictable. The overall results are highly predictable. And what we can predict is really exponential change. And since these technologies already have a lot of traction, multiplying them by 1,000 in 10 years, a billion in 25 years, we'll see some very profound changes ahead. So I'm going to show you a few dozen examples of this phenomena. We have hundreds of them. And you'll see just how smooth these exponential trends are, despite the vagaries of human history, wars and recessions and competing IPO programs and so on. Now, before I do that, I want to share with you a piece of technology that we just came up with. It's actually a good example of what I'm talking about, because the primary application of these technology models we have is to time my own technology projects. Although it does have this side benefit that we can anticipate where technology will go, not just 4 years from now, but 10 years or 20 years from now, and at least assess the kind of impact it will have on areas of our civilization, such as education. But I've been involved with reading machines for the blind for 30 years. We also have a version for dyslexic kids, the Kurzweil 3000. There's about 100,000 of those systems in the field, used by about 500,000 kids. And the first reading machine for the blind was about the size of a dishwasher, and it's 1,000 times smaller than the one, larger than the one we just came out with, which is pocket size. But because I've been involved in this field for 30 years, I would speak at technology disabilities conferences, and the reading machine got smaller and smaller over the years, but it remained a desk-based system. Prior to this one, the principal reading machine was the Kurzweil 1000, which is small, but sits on your desk. You have to bring reading material back to your desk. Now, there's a lot of things you want to read that you can't bring back to your desk, like a sign on a wall or the bank ATM display. You could bring the menu from the restaurant back to your desk, but you'd really rather read it in the restaurant. Handouts at a meeting, all kinds of reading material that you read constantly as you go through the day. It's really part of being able to see that blind people haven't been able to read because they can't bring it back to their desk to read it. So I would give predictions on a regular basis that will someday a blind person be able to take a device out of their pocket and just snap a picture and read material as they go through the day. And in 2002, the president of the National Federation of the Blind, it's the largest organization of blind people, it's about 50,000 blind people, and I'd worked with them on the original Kurzweil reading machine in the mid-70s. So Dr. Maurer said, okay, Ray, you've been talking about this, when do you think this will be feasible? And he said, well, according to our models of technology development, the requisite digital camera and pocket computer technology will become available in 4 years, 2006, second quarter to be exact. And then he said, okay, well, how long will it take to develop the software? And I said, well, we need more than just putting the character recognition and text-to-speech synthesis in the pocket computer. We need a new layer of software, because as the blind person holds the device, there's going to be three different degrees of freedom of rotation and tilt. There's uneven illumination in the real world. Pages are curved. And I listed six or seven different vagaries of real world images that you don't have in the controlled environment of a scanner. And he said, oh, okay, how long will that take? 4 years. So he said, all right, let's get started. So we started in 2002, right on schedule, second quarter of this year, the requisite digital camera and pocket computer technology became available to make this feasible. And actually, a little bit to my surprise, the software project actually got done on time. And we introduced this in July. There's now about 1,000 guys and gals going around taking pictures of labels in their clothing, spines of music CDs, remainders at the table in the bookstores, and reading printed material as they go through the day. And other people now are noticing, oh, the digital cameras and pocket computers can do this. They're starting to develop now. And if we had done that, this wouldn't have come out for several years.
The system is in shooting. Camera is off. I'm ready. Camera is on. field of view report. Top, bottom, and left edges are visible. Taking picture.
So the field of view report is actually a pretty complex feature. A blind person can just point it at a wall.
Pre-processing picture.
And it will tell them, well, this print that you're cutting off the left edge, move to the right.
Camera is 0 degrees clockwise relative to
so
the page.
So I actually hit it right on, but it could be any rotation.
The AI went to this long since cover.
We are going to the spring of Neuro AI. Most of the examples above were research projects just 10 to 15 years ago. If all the AI systems in the world suddenly stopped functioning, our economic infrastructure would grind to a halt. Your bank would cease doing business. Most transportation would be crippled. Most communications would fail. This was not the case a decade ago. Of course, AI systems are not smart enough yet to organize such a conspiracy. Strong AI. If you understand something in only one way, then you don't really understand it at all. This is because, if something goes wrong, you get stuck with a thought that just sits in your mind with nowhere to go. This speaking cancelled. Camera is off. An unsaved thought, goodbye.
And it's another good example of using technology to overcome disabilities. I think that technology has been a great enabler and equalizer in terms of overcoming sensory and physical disabilities, and that's going to accelerate as well. So let me show you, and let me comment actually on that passage, because the passage was talking about artificial intelligence. There are hundreds of examples of narrow artificial intelligence, machines doing things that used to require human intelligence, but doing them generally better and faster and more reliably within narrow constraints. But these were research projects just 15 years ago. And there are hundreds of examples of these. I mean, every time you send an email or connect a cell phone call, intelligent algorithms route the information, intelligent algorithms fly and land airplanes, guide intelligent weapon systems, help design products, control just-in-time inventory levels, control automated factories. You get an electrocardiogram, it comes back with an automatic diagnosis, it rivals that of doctors, same for blood cell images, conduct billions of dollars in financial transactions each day automatically. And the narrowness of these applications is gradually getting less narrow. And I'll talk about the future course of that as we go forward. Now, I mentioned that the paradigm shift rate, basically the rate of progress, is doubling every decade. And we have hundreds of examples of this, but these are log graphs. As you go up the graph, it represents multiplying whatever you're measuring, by, generally by powers of 10, not adding to it. So a straight line on a logarithmic graph is exponential growth. But the telephone, which was actually the first virtual reality technology, you could actually be with someone else, even if you were hundreds of miles apart, hold a conversation. That had never happened before. But that took 50 years, half a century, to be adopted by a quarter of the U.S. population. Cell phone did that in 7 years. If we look at these different communication technologies, telephone, radio, television took decades to be adopted. The cell phone, the web, the PC were adopted in a few years' time. This has continued to accelerate. I gave a few examples a few minutes ago. And I have a whole theory as to why this is the case. I don't want to dwell on this, but This shows the continual acceleration of both biological evolution and the technology evolution that emerged from the biological evolutionary process that gave rise to the technology creating species. And the reason that evolution accelerates is it creates a capability, evolves a capability, and then it adopts that capability, uses it in evolving the next stage. That's why the next stage goes more quickly. So the very first paradigm shift in biology, basically the evolution of DNA, actually RNA came first, a little computer system underlying evolution, so evolution could keep track of its experiments. That took a billion years. But then evolution adopted DNA, the Cambrian explosion, when all the body plans of the animals evolved, that went 100 times faster, about 10 million years. And then the body plans did not evolve after that time, they became basically a mature technology, so evolution concentrated on something else. Higher cognitive functions. That only took a few million years. And then Homo sapiens evolved in only a few hundred thousand years. And there's actually only three simple genetic changes that comprise only a few tens of thousands of bytes in the genome that distinguish us from our primate ancestors. We have a larger skull to allow for a bigger brain at the expense of a weaker jaw, so don't get into a biting contest with another primate. More of the brain is devoted to the cerebral cortex. We can do abstract reasoning. We can do what-if experiments in our mind. What if I took that stone and that stick and tied them together with that twine? I could extend my leverage. And then we had an opposable appendage that actually worked well to allow us to carry out those experiments and change the environment and create tools and then use the tools to create other tools. And you might think that other primates have a similar hand, like chimpanzees' hands look similar. The pivot point of the thumb is down 1 inch. It's just a bad design. They don't have a power grip. They don't have fine motor coordination. If you watch a chimp holding a stick, they're pretty clumsy. We could actually change the environment. That brought in this whole other evolutionary process, and that went a little bit faster. The first steps in technology evolution, stone tools, fire, the wheel, took tens of thousands of years. And then we always use the latest generation of technology to evolve the next generation. 50 years ago, the first computers were actually designed pen on paper, wired with screwdrivers. We now use computers and 10th generation computer assisted design software to design computers, and it can be done in a matter of days. And you can see on this double log graph, it's a straight line showing this continual acceleration. If you look at this, where the x-axis is linear, not logarithmic, it looks like everything has just happened. But some people said, okay, Kurzweil only put points on this graph if they fit on the straight line. And if they didn't fit on the straight line, they didn't bother to put the points on there. So I took 14 different lists, Carl Sagan's Cosmic Calendar, the Encyclopedia Britannica, American Museum of Natural History, about a dozen other lists, as to what they thought the key events were in biological and technological evolution. And there's some disagreement. Some people include the ARPANET with the internet, so it's 25 years, not 10 years, and some people think the cavern explosion took 25 million years, not 10 million years. There's disagreement when human language started. But there's a very clear trend line, a very clear acceleration. Nobody thinks the internet took a million years. No one thinks the Cambrian explosion happened in 10 years. A billion years ago, not much happened in a million years. There's a very clear acceleration in this evolutionary process. And information technologies double even faster. They're now doubling every year, and even that rate is speeding up. When I came to MIT, a computer that took about the size of one of these sections here, it was the MIT computer, an IBM 7984, a quarter of a MIP, 144,000 bytes of memory, cost $11 million, 1,000 times less powerful than the computer in your cell phone today. And you've probably heard of Moore's Law, which talks about this acceleration of electronics. Basically, Moore's Law says we're shrinking the features on an integrated circuit so we can put more of them on there at an exponential pace. But Moore's Law is really just one example of many of this exponential growth in computation. And computation is just one example of this exponential growth in information. It applies to biological information, it applies to communications, it applies to brain data. And really, any time we can measure the information content of a process, we find that it's growing exponentially. Here I put 49 famous computers on a logarithmic graph, going back to, prior to the end of the 19th century. The lower left-hand corner is the first data processing equipment that was used to automate an American census, the 1890 census. Used these old punch card machines, which were subsequently shipped to the Florida Election Commission. And we've actually gone through a few elections now since we had problems here, so it's very hard to live down a bad reputation. 1940s, we were using telephone relays to crack the German Enigma code. Alan Turing and his colleagues did that, and Roosevelt and Churchill had a complete transcription of all the Nazi messages and a lot of interesting wartime literature and how they were very careful in using that information. They wanted to tip off the enemy they had cracked the code, so they would use various subterfuges. The German sailors would see an English flyer and say, oh, we've been spotted, but actually that was just to trick them into thinking they were spotted and not that their code had been cracked. But in the Battle of Britain, the Royal Air Force was outnumbered 3-1 and won that battle because of the decoding of their secret messages, gave us a launching pad for our D-Day invasion. 1950s, vacuum tubes were used in computation. CBS predicted the election of Eisenhower, the first time the networks did that. Now, people say, you know, exponentials can't go on forever. In fact, this has been one criticism of my prediction, that Kurzweil just takes these exponentials, assumes they'll go on indefinitely. That is not the case. Exponentials do run out of steam. Rabbits in Australia multiply exponentially. They hit a wall when they eat up all the foliage and the exponential growth stops. And each one of these paradigms similarly runs out of steam. So they were shrinking vacuum tubes each year, making them smaller and smaller and keeping this exponential growth going. Finally, they hit a wall. They couldn't shrink the vacuum tubes and keep the vacuum, and that was the end of the shrinking of vacuum tubes. It was not the end of the overall growth of information technology or of computation. We then went to a different paradigm. Every time one paradigm came to an end, it created research pressure to create the next paradigm. So the fourth paradigm was transistors, the fifth paradigm was integrated circuits, and Moore's Law. There have been regular predictions that Moore's Law will come to an end. The first predictions were 2002, Intel now says 2022. By that time, the key features will be 4 nanometers in size by 20 carbon atoms, and we won't be able to shrink them anymore. And that'll be the end of Moore's Law, but that won't be the end of this exponential growth. We'll go to the sixth paradigm, which is already working in laboratories. Basically, that is computing in three dimensions, not two. Chips today are flat, they're two-dimensional. We live in a three-dimensional world. Our brain is organized in three dimensions. And our brain actually uses a very inefficient, cumbersome information processing method. It sends signals using chemical signals, which travel a few hundred feet per second. That's a million times slower than electronics. The computations take place in the inner neuronal connections, which compute 200 calculations per second. That's a million times slower than electronics today. But it gets its power by being massively parallel and organized in three dimensions. And we will go into three dimensions with these very fast electronic circuits. That was actually a controversial assertion when I predicted that in my 1999 book, The Age of Spiritual Machines. That's very much a mainstream view today because these circuits are already beginning to work. A nanotube circuit-based memory is actually going to hit the market next year. If you talk to the Intel scientists, as I have, they will tell you, yes, we've got self-organizing, three-dimensional circuits working in labs. The crossover point will be in the teen years, well before we run out of steam with Moore's Law. And you'll notice that's not a straight line on this log graph. That's actually another exponential. It took us 3 years to double the price performance of computing in 1900, 2 years in the middle of the century. It was 1 year in the year 2000. It's already now down to 11 months. And supercomputers marching along. Actually, according to this chart, will hit 10 to the 16th calculations per second, 10 million billion calculations per second, which is the most conservative estimate of the amount of computation required to simulate all several hundred regions of the human brain by 2013. Actually, 6 weeks after the singularity came out, Singularity's Near came out, which was about a year ago, Japan announced two supercomputer projects to hit that in 2010. And I don't want to dwell on these examples of electronics, but look at this chart here. This is the price of a transistor. So when I was a high school student growing up in New York, I would hang out at the surplus electronic shops in Canal Street, which is still there, and I'd buy something about this big, which was a telephone, really, equivalent to one transistor, only a lot slower, for $40. And come 1968, you could buy a whole transistor a lot faster than my relay for just $1. Well, in 2002, you could buy 10 million transistors for a dollar, and today it's 100 million. Now, you've probably heard these fantastic comparisons of where we've come in electronics, and by the way, we'll make similar progress in the future. But what's even more interesting about this graph is look at how smooth this progression is. I mean, it looks like it's the output of some tabletop, you know, science lab experiment, but this is actually the measure of millions of people in hundreds of companies, dozens of countries, all kinds of vagaries of human history with accusations of one country dumping products on another and wars and recessions. And out of all that unpredictable human behavior comes this very smooth, very predictable progression, an exponential progression, going from one transistor to 10 million in a short period of time for the same price. And unlike Gertrude Stein's roses, it's not the case that a transistor is a transistor, as we've made them cheaper. They're actually better because they're smaller, the electrons have less distance to travel, and we have exponential growth in the speed. So the cost of a transistor cycle has come down by half every 1.1 year. You add other levels of innovation. We basically have doubled the price performance of electronics and computing every year. It turns out to be the same phenomena for genetic data, brain data, all, take both hardware and software, we're doubling the price performance every year. That's a 50% inflation rate, and the economists will worry about inflation or deflation depending on what week it is. I think the Fed is back on inflation. But they'll tell you deflation's bad too. We had massive deflation during the Depression. And there are economists worried about this 50% deflation factor in information technology because the portion of the economy that's comprised of information technology is itself growing and will be most of the economy by the 2020s. So while nominally it's a good thing, these economists would say that as a consumer you could buy the same stuff for half the money a year later, that's going to lead to a shrinking in the economy if almost the entire economy is information technology. Because yes, people will increase their consumption somewhat, but they're not going to literally double their consumption year after year to keep up with this 50% deflation rate. So the overall economy will shrink, and that has negative consequences. That is actually not what we see. We more than double our consumption. Despite the fact that you can get the same stuff in information technology for half the money, the information technology sector has grown 18% per year for the last 50 years. And in fact, that is the source of economic growth, because as the more and more of the economy is reflected in information technology, and that's growing 18% in constant currency, it's actually fueling economic growth. The non-information technology industries are shrinking in size. And the reason for that is that when price performance reaches certain levels, whole new applications explode on the landscape. People didn't buy iPods for $10,000 10 years ago, which is what it would have cost. I gave a presentation a few weeks ago at the offsite meeting of the directors of National Institutes of Health and the chief scientists, and we talked about their program now to collect 1 million genomes so they can reliably link genes to disease states. It's going to be a very powerful research tool. Well, that wasn't feasible when the genome cost $1 billion, and that's how much the first genome cost. We're now very close to a $1,000 genome, and collecting 1 million of them is feasible. You didn't have, junior high school and high school kids and elementary school kids, buying high-definition video equipment even 3 years ago. But now that that's feasible, that market has opened up. Magnetic data storage, I just put this up here because it's a different technology, same exponential trend. And medicine, health, is undergoing a profound transformation from being basically a hit-or-miss affair. We just find something, here's something that lowers blood pressure. We don't know why this works, but it seems to be beneficial. But because we did not understand how these drugs work, they invariably have lots of side effects. 99% of the drugs on the market today were done that way. That's why drugs have such a mixed reputation. It's called drug development, was called drug discovery, and we would automate that, but still, we didn't really design drugs. That's now shifting to rational drug design, where we can literally reprogram biology. I mean, how much software do you have that you haven't changed in 30 weeks, let alone 30,000 years? Well, we have these 23,000 software programs inside us called genes, and basically they are software programs. They're strings of data, they express themselves in three-dimensional means, and they affect the information processes underlying our body, and they haven't changed much in thousands of years. I mentioned the fat insulin receptor gene. That was a good design 1,000 years ago. If you happen upon some calories, well, you probably didn't just happen upon them. You probably worked hard to get them. You needed to store them. We didn't have refrigerators. You needed to store them in your body. And in fact, the fat insulin receptor gene was the innovation that allowed animals to roam around because plants don't have a fat insulin receptor gene. Well, that now underlies an epidemic of obesity. And when we turned them off in the fat cells, people were able to remain at an optimal weight despite the amount of food they ate. And this is just one of the 23,000 genes we'd like to modify in some way. We've identified genes that are critical for heart disease and cancer to progress. And there are over 1,000 drug developments using this new method we have now that can reliably turn genes off, RNA interference. That only emerged 3 years ago. And 2 weeks ago, discoverers of RNA interference just got the Nobel Prize. And that's turning genes off. There's many other approaches. We can add new genes. I'm involved with one company where we take a cell outside the body, modify it in vitro, expect that it's been done right, check that it has no other DNA errors, replicate it millions fold, which is a well-established technology, inject it back into the patient. These are modified lung cells. We've actually added a new gene to that cell. And these cells go through the bloodstream, they're lung cells, they don't end up in the heart or the liver, they end up in the lungs, and they've cured a fatal disease, pulmonary hypertension, and it's now undergoing human trials. And we can reprogram biology at other levels. For example, enzymes. Pfizer's torsatropin precisely turns off one enzyme at one stage of atherosclerosis. And it's, the phase 2 trial showed that it stops atherosclerosis, which accounts for 90% of all heart attacks. So far as they're spending a record $1 billion on the phase 3 trials. And that looks like it's going very well and will be a very dramatic drug for really dramatically cutting down on heart disease. And there are thousands of these developments in the pipeline. But what's interesting is that now that health and biology and medicine, this $2 trillion industry, is going from this hit-or-miss affair to being an information technology, it's subject to this law of accelerating returns, which is a doubling of the paradigm shift rate every decade and a doubling of the power of these information technologies every year. The general project itself was not a mainstream project when it was announced in 1990. We assumed that that must have been a big announcement because its completion was a big announcement, but that was a renegade project. The mainstream skeptics dismissed it, saying, "You're never going to be able to do this in 15 years. We just had our best PhD students and our most advanced equipment around the world, and we collected 1/10,000th of the genome in 1989. It'll speed up some, but it'll be a century or more before we complete this." And the skeptics are going strong halfway through the project, saying, "Look, you're 7.5 years now into a 15-year project, and you finished 1% of the project. That's pretty pathetic. But if you double 1% 7 more times, which is exactly what happened, the project got completed on time, and this has continued since that time. And every other aspect of biology, now reverse engineering the genome, now that we've collected it, relating it to disease states, understanding how they express themselves in proteins, the proteome project, all these different aspects of biology are gearing up at the same exponential pace. We went from $10 per base pair in 1990, 2 cents in 2004, it's under a penny today. This slope on this log graph represents a doubling of price performance every year. Again, look at how smooth this graph is. You'd think that maybe it'd be very erratic because there's all this competition in the biotechnology field, but no, it's a very smooth progression. It's not because it was programmed by some government agency. That's just the way these technologies work. Communication is doubling every year. There's many different ways to measure this. This has profound implications on education. The internet is very democratizing of education. You can have kids interact with teachers and kids from around the world. I went to MIT in 1965. I'm on the board now, and we have a program to give away all MIT courses for free called OpenCourseWare on the web. And you already have thousands of schools around the world in Nigeria and Algeria and Pakistan and China where kids gather around a computer and take an MIT course. They don't get credit from MIT, but they get credit from their local institution, and they're getting this quality material. That will soon include full archiving of video lectures. You basically will be able to take all of these MIT courses for free. Ultimately, we will have full immersion virtual reality, because we'll have images written directly to our retina from our eyeglasses and lenses. This technology already exists. It can put you in a full immersion, highly realistic, convincing three-dimensional environment. I actually have a technology like that that I use to give my lectures. I'm the only speaker in the world that has one in his office. And I appear in the venue, I look three-dimensional. I can't wander around like this, I have to be behind a special podium, but it looks like I'm really there. And as I move around, the audience sees the local background behind me. I'm life-size, photorealistic, real-time, and three-dimensional. So this is expensive technology today. This will be ubiquitous in the future. You'll be able to enter these virtual reality environments with electronics you have in your clothing, images written directly to your retina. So you'll be able to then take these MIT classes or PS188 classes, or people in poor, in developing nations, if they don't have enough teachers for every classroom, these kids will be able to enter virtual reality environments and get high quality K through 12 college and postgraduate education in every language around the world. And this is scaling up exponentially. I mean, here's this little graph I had in the 1980s. I had a little piece of this when I wrote my first book 20 years ago, showing the ARPANET doubling every year. And so it was clear to me that this would be a worldwide communication network in the mid-1990s. But if you look at the same data on a linear scale, it looks like this. And we live in a linear world. This is how we experience the world. So to the casual observer, it looked like the World Wide Web came out of nowhere in the mid-1990s, but you could see it coming if you looked at the exponential progressions. We're shrinking technology, a rate of 100 for 3D volume per decade, and these various these are actually illustrations from Eric Drexler's 1986 book that introduced nanotechnology. It was actually a controversial thesis at MIT in 1986. But we're now actually building these systems at the molecular level. Now, we will ultimately have blood cell-sized devices that can go inside the human body and keep us healthy from inside. If that sounds really futuristic, I'd point out we're doing it already in many animal experiments with at least the first generation of these devices. One scientist cured type 1 diabetes in rats with a nano-engineered blood cell-sized device that has 7 nanometer pores, lets insulin out in a carefully controlled fashion, blocks antibodies because type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disorder, and actually works, and they're going into human trials. That's today. At MIT, scientists have a blood cell-sized device that can detect cancer cells by detecting the antigens on their surface, latches onto the surface, burrows inside the cell, releases toxins, destroys the cell, and then destroys itself. Pretty complicated set of procedures. That's today. This is undergoing animal trials. This is a design for a robotic red blood cell. We understand how red blood cells work. They basically store and release oxygen. They're not that complicated. And it shows an interesting insight into biology. Biology is very intricate, complex, and clever, but it's also very suboptimal. When we discover the principles of operation of different biological systems, we find we can re-engineer them to be thousands of times more capable. In this robotic red blood cell, it's been evaluated, and analysis indicates if you replace 10% of your red blood cells with these respiracytes, you can do an Olympic sprint for 15 minutes without taking a breath or sit at the bottom of your pool for 4 hours. So, Honey, I'm in the Pool will take on a whole new significance. So, we will have plenty of computation to simulate the human brain by the 2020s. The source of the software will ultimately be actually learning how the human brain itself works. It's not hidden from us, and we're gearing up exponentially on that. The spatial resolution of brain scanning is doubling every year. The amount of data we're collecting is doubling every year. But then an interesting question is, can we make any sense out of this data? Doug Hofstadter has said, well, probably our brain is just below that threshold necessary to understand our brain. And if we were smarter and able to understand it, well, then necessarily our brain would have to be that much more complicated and we'd never catch up with it. It turns out that that's not the case. As we gather data about different regions of the brain, we're finding that we can create mathematical models and simulations of these regions. This is a dozen regions of the auditory cortex that have been modeled and simulated, and then we applied sophisticated psychoacoustic tests to the simulation. We get similar results as applying them to human auditory perception. There's similarly a model and simulation of the cerebellum, which is where we do our skill formation. It's an important region responsible for half of our neurons. And similarly, this performs very well in tests. And it brings up an interesting issue, which is how complicated is the human brain? Well, if I show you human brain, it appears very complicated. I've estimated it would take thousands or trillions of bytes to characterize the state of a human brain, all the ion channels and neurotransmitter levels and so on. If I showed you the cerebellum, and I said, here, reverse engineer this, you go, this will be beyond this. It'll take centuries. There's trillions of connections deeply intertwined in very convoluted ways. Well, we have figured it out. It's actually not that complicated. There's only a few genes that control it. There's only a few tens of thousands of bytes in the design. Basically, there's one pattern that's repeated 10 billion times with a little bit of random variation each time. And the design of the human brain is only 30 to 50 million bytes. That's a billion times simpler than its instantiation. How do we know that? Well, the design of the human brain is in the genome. And the genome doesn't have that much information in it. It's replete with redundancies. You can therefore compress it. The compressed genome is only about 50 million bytes, which is actually less than Microsoft Word. And my point is not that the brain is simple, but it's a level of complexity that we can understand. I make the case in my book that by the mid-2020s, about 20 years from now, when we have the 40th anniversary of of this conference. We will actually have all the models and simulations of the human brain, and that will give us greater insight into ourselves. That will allow us more powerful tools to fix what goes wrong with the brain. We'll understand precisely what goes wrong in the brain of, let's say, someone with schizophrenia or bipolar disease. And we will also have more powerful methodologies for our artificial intelligence research. All of this is growing economic gains. I don't want to dwell on this, but look at this chart here. This is e-commerce growing exponentially. It's now over $1 trillion. You might say, now, wait a second, wasn't there a boom and a bust in these dot-coms? How come we don't see that? That was just a Wall Street phenomenon. Wall Street looked at the internet and said, wow, this is going to change everything. This is going to change every business model. They said that in the late 1990s. And that was true. And it's going to happen exponentially, but that doesn't mean instantaneously. So Wall Street came back 3 years later and said, gee, it hasn't changed every business model. I guess we were wrong and all the values went the other way. But meanwhile, it was growing exponentially, but doubling small numbers. Now we're up to $1 trillion. And let me show you one more. Well, education, I mentioned this earlier. I mean, this, if you take the broad view and go back 100 years, you see a dramatic increase in all levels of expenditure in education because of the fact that the skill ladder is going up and creating these new complex jobs up here, eliminating the routine jobs at the bottom of the skill ladder. Let me show you one more example of a technology we put together and then just draw some conclusions as to what impact this will have. One of my companies created the first text-to-speech synthesis in the 70s, and another of my companies created the first large vocabulary speech recognition in the 80s. We took contemporary versions of that, put it together with language translation software, which is coming along, and created a translating telephone. This will be of significance to education in that it will overcome the language barrier. It's not perfect today, but it works pretty well, and this will be a routine service of your cell phone or your PC early in the next decade. This is a demonstration. Kava.
Dies ist eine Demonstration.
Of a prototype. Of a quote translating end quote telephone. Period.
Von einem Prototyp eines übersetzenden Telefons.
Within a few years, Kava.
Innerhalb einiger Jahre.
We will be able to talk to anyone. Kava.
Wir werden fähig sein, zu jemandem zu reden.
Regardless of their language. Period.
Ohne Rücksicht auf ihre Sprache.
The rain in Spain. Kava.
La pluie en Espagne.
Stays mainly in the plain. Period.
Reste dans la plaine principalement.
Merci pour votre attention. Period.
Thank you for your attention.
Excuse my French. And that is synthetic speech. It might sound recorded, but synthetic speech has come along because we've been studying prosodics and we have a more natural inflection that reflects what's being said. So let me just take a few minutes to wrap up and talk about some of the implications. Early in the next decades, computers will disappear. They won't be these little objects we carry around. There'll be an embedded web of computing in the environment, in our clothing. We'll be online all the time with very high bandwidth wireless connection. Images will be written into our retina. That'll solve this dilemma between having a very large screen but also having small devices. We'll have these tiny devices that write very large images onto our retina, so you could have a virtual screen, high definition that floats in the air, or that takes over your whole visual field of view for full immersion virtual reality. Or you could have augmented real reality. So as you look around the world, you'll have little pop-up displays. There's already cars that where the navigation system is not a little display off to the right, but is actually in the window in front of you. So as you actually look at the road, there's actually an image superimposed on the actual road that shows you exactly where to go. Well, this will be built into our eyeglasses. You look at someone, a little pop-up will appear reminding you it's their birthday next Tuesday, reminding you what their name is, and that would be helpful. And we'll have effective language translations. All of this will continue to make this a smaller world, and will benefit the kind of communication that education depends on. In 2029, we'll have about a billion-fold increase in the power of these technologies, 100,000-fold shrinking of the size of key features and three-dimensional volume of both electronic and mechanical technology. These trends will really come to full fruition. We'll have a full understanding of how the human brain works, which will give us new insight into ourselves. It will allow us to apply these techniques to very powerful computers. Our computation, which is becoming increasingly powerful, is not an alien invasion of intelligent machines to compete with us. It is amplifying our mental capabilities. It does that right now. I mean, every time you sit down in a search engine and very quickly find out, get access to some professor's work, we're increasing our intellect and expanding our horizons. And this is really what our species does. We're the species that goes beyond our limitations. We are already amplifying our mental capabilities. And we'll do that very directly. We'll have these blood cell-sized devices. I mentioned there's already a first generation of them being experimented with in animals. But take what's feasible today, multiply it by a billion. These will be very capable. They'll be going inside our bodies, keeping us healthy from inside, removing debris, destroying pathogens and cancer cells, reversing atherosclerosis, correcting DNA errors. They'll go into our brains through our capillaries, interact with our biological neurons. Now, we already have computers you can put inside your brain. If you're a Parkinson's patient, for example, you can have the biological neurons today that are destroyed by that disease replaced with a computer, and the biological neurons in the vicinity now get signals from a computer, whereas they used to get signals from the neurons, and they're perfectly happy. And the latest generation of this FDA-approved neural implant allows you to download new software into the neural implant in your brain from outside the patient. That's today. By the end of the 2020s, these nanobots inside the brain, which can go in there non-invasively, can interact directly with our biological neurons, provide direct mental communication to the web, or from person to person, provide full immersion virtual reality experiences from inside the nervous system, and generally expand human intelligence and capability. And it's really a continuation of a story that goes back to the dawn of technology. And one more trend I'll leave you with. I mentioned we're the species that goes beyond our limitations, and one of the limitations we've gone beyond is our longevity. When our genes evolved, it was not in the interest of the species for people to live past childrearing. And childrearing 1,000 years ago meant like age 25, you were done raising your kids. And human life expectancy post-infant mortality was about 25 1,000 years ago. It was only 37 in 1800, that's 200 years ago. There was no sanitation, so people got bacterial infections, there were no antibiotics, they didn't understand what infections were, and life was very short, brutish, disaster and disease-filled, as Thomas Hobbes described it in 1800. 1900 was only 48. When we put Social Security legislation in place in the 1930s, 65 was considered old. We really have a different perspective on that now. But this trend will go into high gear and advance very rapidly when we get to the mature phase of this biotechnology revolution, where we can apply this exponentially expanding information technology to reprogram our own biology. And according to my models, 15 years from now, we'll be adding more than a year every year to your remaining life expectancy. So as you go forward a year, your remaining life expectancy will move on away from you. So if you can hang in there for another 15 years, we may get to experience the remarkable century ahead. Thank you very much.